This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. When anthrax was discovered in U.S. mail last fall, we asked, is our public health system up to such a challenge? But bioterrorism is not the only threat we face. Mother Nature is a fiercer foe. There are food-borne pathogens out there, deadly viruses, superbacteria, and antibiotic resistance. Journalist Madeline Drexler joins us today for the Afternoon Magazine. Her beat is science and medicine. She is the author of a new book about emerging infections titled Secret Agents, The Menace of Emerging Infections. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Madeline Drexler. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Madeline Drexler wrote a syndicated medical column for the Boston Globe from 1988 to 1996. She has also been a staff writer for the Cleveland Plain Dealer magazine and a photographer for the Associated Press. Her articles have appeared in many magazines. Her book, Secret Agents, The Menace of Emerging Infections, is published by the Joseph Henry Press. Again, those telephone numbers, 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Madeline Drexler, good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you for joining us this
afternoon.
Let's begin with a couple of really basic, very basic questions. How is emerging infection defined, and when was the term coined?
Well, this is a term that really comes from the late 80s, early 90s. It was coined because around that time, suddenly it seemed public health was confronted by a ton of emerging infections. We had Legionnaires' disease that actually came about in 76. Lyme disease started spreading in the early 80s. We had toxic shock syndrome, E. coli 0157H7, Hamburger disease. We had all kinds of new STDs and then infections out of Africa, such as Ebola and Lassa, and of course the preeminent emerging infection, which is AIDS.
Hmm. Now, are these emerging infections, are they really new, or are they just infections that have suddenly shown up in our populations?
Well, the answer is both. Certainly some of them are not new. The anthrax that we're rediscovering in this country is an age-old infection. Something like West Nile virus jumped here from the Mideast a couple years ago, was endemic for many, many centuries, probably millennia there. But some certainly are new. There are many new antibiotic-resistant bacteria in our hospitals. We are breeding these new organisms by our own medical practices and the way we feed livestock and other things. And other foodborne infections are new. That is, at least new to science. We've never seen them before. In fact, many of the most common and deadly foodborne infections are ones that 20 years ago we did not know existed.
Hmm. Now, the headlines are pretty frightening. How concerned, how worried should we be?
We should be very worried because our public health system, as we saw during the fall anthrax attacks, is not up to a major epidemic of any of these. For many years, our public health system has been neglected. You may know that earlier in this century, we really thought we had these infections licked. We had new antibiotics coming out in the 30s and 40s, and it seemed, in fact, an eminent virologist, a Nobel laureate, said that it seemed as if the era of infectious disease was going to pass. This was a famous quote from a 1962 book that he wrote. So we neglected public health. We neglected research, basic research, into anti-infectives, and suddenly, as I mentioned, in the late 70s, early 80s, and of course today, these things have come back to haunt us.
Mm-hmm. Here's something to think about. I'm going to share this with the audience. You quote a virologist who says, 100 years from now, we may still be worried about tuberculosis, while having managed to get rid of most of the underlying causes of heart disease, which is currently the number one killer.
That's right. I was making a point there about this notion of the epidemiological transition. That's the idea that as nations become more developed, that infectious disease will inevitably dwindle, and what will be left would be chronic diseases like heart disease and cancer. Well, I think recent history proves that is not true, that we may, in this country and everywhere, perfect techniques that would reduce the incidence of these chronic diseases, but infectious microorganisms are endlessly creative, and we will never constrain them. We can only sort of hold them at bay.
Mm. Now, we've made great strides in nutrition and hygiene and food safety. We have vaccinations. We have antibiotics. But you point out that in many ways, our risks for these emerging infections have increased. And maybe what we could do here is talk about some of these increased risks. And one that everyone will think of, I think, right off the top of their head is that we can travel around the world in the space of 2 days.
Actually, a scientist told me in the course of my researching this book that if you put your finger on any point on the globe, you can get there from any other point within 36 hours, and that's less than the incubation time of most diseases. So in other words, if a human being or a mosquito or an animal that was infected went from one part of the world to another, they could bring infection, bring disease, before anyone noticed that there were symptoms of that disease.
You quote the cartoonist Gary Larson, be a virus, see the world.
Yes.
These things can travel great distances and travel very quickly. Mm-hmm. Also, not only are we traveling, but things are coming to us.
Mm-hmm.
Our foods come from all around the world now.
That's right. It's incredible. I don't think most of us realize that when we go to the grocery store, that in certain seasons, certain times of the winter, 75% of our produce, our fresh fruits and vegetables, come from other countries. And certainly globalization is an irreversible process, and it's a good thing, but we can't always be sure that the food that we eat is grown in places that meet our own sanitary standards. So the result is cyclospora on our raspberries. It's hepatitis A on strawberries. We have alfalfa sprouts with salmonella. We have shigella on green onions. It's incredible the amount of bacteria that are showing up on these.
Doing the research for this book, has it caused you to change the way you eat or change the way you prepare foods?
A little bit. I mean, as my friends know, I don't follow an exemplary diet, but I will say after writing the third chapter of my book, which is on foodborne illness, I shy away from salad bars. I absolutely make sure that every hamburger I eat, I still eat hamburgers, but I make sure that they're really cooked through. But I think the most important thing I learned was that it's not what any individual can do to protect themselves. We really need a public health system, something bigger to ensure that the food we're eating is not contaminated. It's a bigger problem than any one individual can defend against.
Mm-hmm. And it goes beyond borders, and this is a big point of your book. You emphasize that the distinction between national and global threats is totally artificial.
Absolutely, because bacteria, viruses, they don't honor national borders. Any threat to any part of the world, I mean, we've certainly seen this with bioterrorism, but we see it in every other realm, too, in foodborne infections and in antibiotic-resistant bacteria in vector-borne diseases like West Nile virus. There are no national borders anymore, and the pace and the frequency of travel, not just for human beings, but for all manner of life, is increasing.
Mm. So we're living in a time when public health issues need to be addressed globally. To what extent are we doing that?
We're doing it more than we were even 5 years ago. You know, I have to say, in looking at this, I was very impressed by the efforts of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Now, I know that some may feel he's a mogul that has destroyed certain competitive practices, but my own finding, at least in the realm of public health, is that this foundation, which has poured billions of dollars into global health efforts, has catalyzed all kinds of other efforts, has catalyzed private industry and other governments and non-governmental organizations to do the same. This foundation shamed the United States into pouring money into this. Not enough, but he really did. That foundation practices a kind of venture philanthropy, I've heard it called, and suddenly many other individual philanthropists and organizations are jumping on the bandwagon.
Mm. Talk with us a little bit more about the importance of thinking about this issue globally. And I think, I don't know whether it's you who says this in the book or if you quote someone who says it is, if we wouldn't have a problem, we wouldn't have this disease in New York City if we'd stopped it in Nairobi or,
right,
you know, wherever. Draw your own, put your own points on the map, but it just makes sense to get at the root.
Absolutely. What we need internationally is what we're trying to attain here in the United States, a very sensitive disease surveillance system and a response system. You know, there are parts of Africa, India, certainly Asia, that just don't have these kinds of systems in place. The dry public health term is infrastructure. We still need more infrastructure in the United States, but there are some places that are actually launching pads for the next emerging infection that have virtually no surveillance. And so what the Gates Foundation, many other groups too, of course, the WHO and even the CDC is involved in this, what they're trying to do is build basic infrastructure, train health workers, train lab technicians so that we sort of know on a day-by-day basis what is happening in these other countries.
Tell us about Bill Foege. He works for the mm-hmm. Gates Foundation. Tell us about him.
Oh, this is one of my heroes. It was a privilege to talk to him in writing this book. Bill Foege was involved in actually the smallpox eradication campaign. He was a medical missionary who went to, I think it was Nigeria, in the late 60s. He was the person who, because there came some months when the vaccine, that is the smallpox vaccine supply, was dangerously low, he had to make it go as far as he can, and suddenly he was faced with a potentially very serious outbreak of smallpox. He devised this ring vaccination technique whereby you vaccinate just the people who are ill and the people immediately around them, instead of the old idea of trying to vaccinate 80 or 90% of all the people in the country. It made the vaccine go further, and it was what probably enabled the smallpox eradication campaign to meet its goal by 1977. And then Foege went to the CDC. He was actually at the CDC when this plethora of emerging infections, so-called, hit. And then he went to the Gates Foundation and helped, the Carter Center, and helped eradicate river blindness and other diseases from Africa. And now he is one of the leading lights at the Gates Foundation.
Hmm. One of the things that he said to you that really struck me as being very important is that we can look at a problem in a developing nation like measles, and we can say, oh, measles is a problem, but it's not the only problem.
Right.
And measles can cause death, but chances are that the person who is killed by measles, that was just the last, that was the last thing their body could handle.
That's right. Their poverty breeds these compound infections, and up close he has seen people who've died of measles but also had all kinds of parasitic infections in their bodies, who had influenza, just a mess of endemic infections. And his point is that we need basic infrastructure to help people achieve basic health in those countries.
Can emerging infections be predicted?
No, they can't. Let me amend that. To an extent, they can, but ultimately, they cannot. In 1979, who would have thought of something like AIDS? It would have been beyond anyone's comprehension to predict an AIDS. But, of course, by then, we now know that AIDS was affecting millions of people around the world. And, in fact, we now know that AIDS, the AIDS virus, probably entered the human population around 1930. So can these be predicted? No. What is known is that they are inevitable, but they are unpredictable. And that's why public health needs absolute steady funding, because we know that these infections will strike us. We don't know when. We have to be on guard all the time.
Mm. There's an entomologist that you write about in the book, mm-hmm. who lives in New York, mm-hmm. Varuni Kula Sekera.
Yes.
And this goes to the point of, you know, to what extent can we predict emerging infections? She saw that there was a big signal, there was a big flag waved in New York in 1999, and she saw a problem, potential problem. She said, you know, we might have a problem this summer, because she saw a problem that winter.
Very interesting story, and she's a very interesting person. She has an incandescent personality. She's just very high wattage. I think she belongs on the big screen. She's a Sri Lankan woman who grew up in very comfortable circumstances, but decided she wanted to be an entomologist. And she lived in a hut in a jungle, in part to complete her studies, came here. And you're right. The winter before the great West Nile virus epidemic, she was asked to investigate an outbreak of mosquitoes, a just fantastic swarm of mosquitoes that was on the Upper East Side, actually near the mayor's house. People at that time were, and this was in the dead of winter, were burning citronella candles and hanging mosquito nets over their beds, and they were wondering what the heck was going on. So Kula Sekera went there, as it happened. She was an expert in the very kind of mosquito that was there. It's called Culex pipiens. This was the day before Christmas, I think. She had a city crew open up a manhole, and out swarmed these Culex. It was a snowstorm, but her eye was so trained to the markings of actually this very drab little mosquito. She knew it was Culex, and she thought, if this mosquito is in such abundance now in December, if it survives into the spring and summer, we're going to have a major arbovirus epidemic.
And West Nile is caused by what's called an arbovirus.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
An arbovirus is a short term for arthropod-borne viruses. Arthropods is it a family? I think I can't remember the exact classification. But arthropods include not only mosquitoes, but ticks and other insects. The arthropoda also includes things like crabs, I think, and other shellfish. But arthropods are what carry these organisms. And the interesting thing there is that these organisms that the arthropods carry, these arboviruses, are very unusual. They have adapted both to the cold-blooded mosquito's body as well as to warm-blooded mammals. It's from an evolutionary point of view, it's a fantastic feat. And so arboviruses include things like not only West Nile virus, but yellow fever virus, St. Louis encephalitis, which you probably get in Illinois.
And so while Varuni Kulasekera is thinking, man, we could have a big problem with mosquito-borne diseases this summer, she didn't know in particular what disease might emerge or diseases.
That's right. The Culex pipiens can carry a number of diseases. Most mosquitoes can. Conversely, many viral diseases can be carried by many different kinds of mosquitoes. So she knew that there was probably going to be a Culex pipiens outbreak in New York that summer. What it could carry was anyone's guess. And as a matter of fact, if you remember, it was anyone's guess. Early in the outbreak, they misdiagnosed what was striking New Yorkers.
They thought it was St. Louis encephalitis.
Right. They thought it was St. Louis encephalitis, but there were people in New York who were very sharp, who had other ideas, and basically they were ignored for weeks until the molecular evidence proved them right.
And West Nile, you're right, wasn't even on the racing card.
No, that's right. You know, for years, entomologists had been saying that the United States is going to be a target for an arboviral invasion from other parts of the world. What they thought would be coming here would be things like Japanese encephalitis, because there are lots of mosquitoes in the United States that can carry that disease. They thought there would be Ross River virus, and they even thought and had written extensively that there could be an outbreak of yellow fever virus, which would just be a historical abomination since we had pretty much cleared that out of the United States much earlier in this century. No one mentioned West Nile virus.
Closer to home, let's talk about Lake Springfield, 1997,
yes.
And a bacterium that took folks a while to figure out what had happened to some athletes.
Right, leptospirosis. Actually, I found that leptospirosis is the most common disease that's passed from animals to humans in the world. At that particular time, there was a triathlon right in Lake Springfield. I think 700 some athletes took part. It was just a wonderfully muggy day, and a triathlon, of course, is swimming, biking, and running. During the swimming portion, these athletes became exposed, probably through tiny scratches in their skin, to leptospirosis, this bacterium. How did it get there? Probably through runoff. The night before, there had been a heavy rainfall. It could have been deposited through the wastes of animals around the lake, and well over 100 athletes became very, very ill from that exposure. But it is not only in those kinds of situations that people get leptospirosis in this country. In my book, I write about the fact that in the inner city of Baltimore, people who are homeless, people who may be out on the street, have also caught leptospirosis from walking on cut glass, and there too it may be rodent waste that they are exposed to.
Mm. And the cities are becoming home to more than people. I mean, a lot of wildlife has moved into town.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, certainly West Nile virus was itself passed, harbored by crows. We have all sorts of ticks and other arthropods that we're not aware of, even in our cities. But more and more people are moving to the wildlife. So many people now live in areas where that have been cleared away from second-growth forests in the Northeast. And this exposes them, of course, to Lyme disease. Lyme disease harbored by deer ticks. It's a major problem, and that is marching westward. Lyme disease is more and more going to be, actually I think it's reached Illinois and it will be moving even further west.
Mm. Are people who work in public health becoming more and more in tune, and are they speaking out about environmental links and the importance of the environment when it comes to thinking about public health?
I think so. For example, I think the most dramatic example that I can think about is people who I spoke to who are at the CDC and in the foodborne diseases branch, and others who look at foodborne disease. They look at the quality of life of these animals, these livestock that we raise for our own food, and they compare those conditions to the conditions of medieval Europe. The chickens and the cattle that we raise they're living in these fetid megacities, and actually what people at CDC are calling for would be a sanitary revolution akin to what we experienced in the 19th century. They want a sanitary revolution for the animals that we eat so that disease-causing bacteria can be finally just washed away.
Hmm. And also, one of the things that you talk about in the book is the over-prescription and overuse of antibiotics, and this is something that's also we've seen in livestock populations.
Absolutely. We feed 70% of the antibiotics produced in this country to animals to make them grow just a little bit fatter than they otherwise would. And actually, it's not even clear that they do fatten up that much. And what this does is breed drug-resistant forms of Campylobacter, of Salmonella, of E. coli, all kinds of organisms that we, in turn, then acquire when we eat undercooked versions of these animals. Factories for antibiotics and germs.
Madeline Drexler is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Secret Agents, The Menace of Emerging Infections. Listeners, your questions and comments are welcome this afternoon. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a listener on line one waiting to talk with us in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. I was just wondering if you could be called a overprotective mother because for a couple of reasons, or maybe even more. One that I think of is that when Carl Voss went down the family tree of life, at the very bottom, he found that organisms were freely exchanging DNA with one another. So to try to kind of insulate yourself, even in the sense of protecting yourself, may be just impossible and beyond our doing wisely. Another reason might be that after all, parasites really don't, it's not their intention to kill off their host, so any kind of infection, normally would not be, at least the underlying intent is not to kill us off as a species. It's more or less just to see if we're a suitable host. And but I think the strongest reason to think that we perhaps shouldn't be too wary of infections, emerging infections, as you've been speaking about, is that recently I read an article where it was found that kids who grew up around farms, for example, where there's a lot of other animals and a lot of different microbes, generally have less infections later on in their life. And from an evolutionary point of view, how can it be a bad thing if what these organisms are doing are finding flaws in our defenses, you know?
Well,
go ahead.
Actually, what you're saying is very true. There's there's evidence, and you're exactly right, that a hyper-clean environment is bad for our immune system, that when the immune system is not exposed to certain bacteria and even certain viruses, when an infant is very, very young, you're right, there's an increased risk of asthma and of allergies. And you're also right that there's kind of a fuzzy line between the human cells, the human organism, and other organisms. There are, for example, 10 times more bacterial cells in and on our body than human cells, and it kind of makes you wonder where one species begins and the other ends. But what I'm concerned about in this book, and I think what these emerging infections really point up, is that there are more and more collisions between organisms that are not adapted to human biology. This is because of changes in culture, in medicine, in our lifestyle that we are creating. And when these organisms enter us, they are so ill-adapted that they cause these very striking and deadly diseases. And it's that kind of public health problem that I want to highlight in the book.
So it sounds like you're saying our society is creating a situation where what would normally be just a transient kind of thing, it may now be catastrophic.
I think that's partly true. And the other thing is that we human beings are causing organisms themselves to change. We're creating these drug-resistant organisms these are not creations of nature. They're creations of humankind. We're transporting organisms all around the world that might not otherwise be transported. And it's the human intervention, some of which are inadvertent, that are causing us to collide with these deadly organisms.
Well, I'll let you go with that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have about 11 minutes left in this portion of the program, and the phone lines are open. Madeline Drexler is our guest this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. She's a journalist. Her beat, Medicine and Science. She's the author of Secret Agents, The Menace of Emerging Infections. My name is Celeste Quinn. You mentioned earlier in the interview E. coli 0157H7. This is an example of a new emerging organism that has cropped up that is lethal.
This is a very interesting organism. The biography of E. coli 0157H7 is very interesting. You know, 20 years ago, we only first got inklings that this thing existed, and that was a hamburger outbreak at a McDonald's. The McDonald's restaurant wasn't identified by the CDC at the time, but they noticed that the number of people were getting very sick from this bacterium, which at that time was unidentified. And only after the 1993, I think, Jack-in-the-Box outbreak, which affected 700 people in the Northwest and killed, I think, 4 children, did researchers go back in their lab files and look at this organism again, and they realized, hey, this is the same organism. But E. coli 0157H7 has actually been around since the 1950s, or so it seems. The striking disease that it causes is this HUS, hemolytic uremic syndrome, bloody diarrhea, and death in up to 7% of victims. And a Swiss pediatrician was noticing this terrible disease in children in Switzerland in the 1950s. And it now appears that it was the use of antibiotics in livestock in Europe and in America that may have promoted the growth of this E. coli 0157H7.
Why is it so fearsome, so lethal?
It's a toxin that it produces. I believe someone told me that the effects that this toxin has is akin to rattlesnake venom. It is so bad, this poison. It's the third most deadly bacterial toxin after those that cause tetanus and botulism. And it travels through the body. It causes tremendous hemorrhaging. The kidneys shut down, and soon there's just total organ failure.
Hmm. And if that's not scary enough, there's an infectious agent out there called a prion.
A prion, yes. Now, prions seem to have repealed the laws of biology. They're still very mysterious. A prion does not have DNA, RNA. It doesn't have any nucleic acid, as far as we can see, and yet it causes infectious disease. They cannot reproduce. These prions do not evoke an immune response. But what happens, and it's been compared to what Kurt Vonnegut wrote about was it Calf's Cradle? I can't remember the name of the book. That these proteins are folded in an abnormal way, and when they come in contact with other proteins, they turn them into prions, and this sets off a chain reaction, and soon it happens in the brain. The entire brain is riddled with holes.
And they resist heat and radiation and ultraviolet light, all the things, sterilization, all the things that we know to kill off infectious agents.
That's right. And there are worries that that prions from infected beef from infected animals in Europe and in Britain may not only have gone into the food supply, but possibly into other manufactured goods like vaccines or makeup, vitamin supplements, other things that are still coming to the United States.
Hmm. And bovine spongiform encephalopathy, mm-hmm. and Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease,
right.
are triggered by prions.
That's right.
Are there other diseases that we know of that are triggered by these things?
Well, Kourou, this disease that was first discovered in Africa, is a prion disease, and that was spread by when people died and their families attended to the body for a funeral. There was a lot of body fluid and other tissue that the family members would come in contact with. I believe, now I can't remember, but I think they actually ingested some parts of the body. And so if this person died of a prion disease, so would the family members, usually women, who arranged the funeral. But there are other prion diseases. There's elk and deer chronic wasting disease in the United States right now. These animals are dying of brain wasting, and there's a real fear that hunters who hunt these animals for meat may themselves be the next prion infected victims.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. In Urbana on line one, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I think Kourou was actually discovered in New Guinea. And it was the product of a protein-deficient society that practiced cannibalism, at least among the females. But what can we do to get our Congress to wake up to the dangers of unlimited use of antibiotics in animals, and also feeding waste, animal waste, to other animals? Because we continue to do this in this country, except we no longer feed bovine waste to other ruminants.
Mm-hmm.
It's still being fed to hogs and chickens.
Right. Well, there's a problem with regulating the livestock industry, agriculture in general, in this country. And that's, among other things, that there are at least 12 or 14 different federal agencies that are in charge of that problem. How do we regulate the unlimited use of antibiotics in animals? Well, you may have seen a report in the New York Times this past weekend that there's a tentative steps to start to do that. But what many public health experts think should happen is that there should be a single food safety agency in this country that regulates issues like that. It probably won't happen soon because people who are on these agriculture committees in the Senate and the House are themselves farmers, and they are perhaps reluctant to regulate their own economic interests.
So we need campaign fund legislation probably before we can get anywhere with that.
Probably. The other problem with regulating antibiotics in animals, I should add, is that it seems to me that the FDA is a singularly weak agency in this country. It's just hamstrung in every way. Not only are they making only very tentative steps towards regulation of antibiotics in animals, but they're also completely understaffed in inspecting foods, other foods, produce that come into this country. They only inspect 1 or 2% of what enters this country as imports.
Pretty discouraging, isn't it?
It's very discouraging. The discouraging thing is we need those agencies to be strong. People cannot be expected to protect themselves at every turn.
Actually, would you say the situation is worse today than it was 40 or 50 years ago?
Oh, in many ways. One way it's worse is that we have this not only a global food supply, but a food supply that is one of mass scale, so that a problem in one ingredient becomes distributed all over the country and actually in other countries too. This is the problem. It's a problem as we've seen in many outbreaks, but for example, it's the problem with these raw alfalfa sprouts. These are made from seeds. These are grown from seeds that come from all parts of the world and then are distributed all over the world. So a salmonella outbreak in alfalfa sprouts, say, is one that I wrote about in the book, can extend from Arizona to Finland. And so it's very hard to track these outbreaks because they're widely diffused. It's not like the old church picnic outbreak, which is known as a point source outbreak. You know, you make the potato salad and the cream puffs, they go bad in the summer heat, but you know exactly who the victims are. In these cases, the attack rate is much lower, but it's widespread. And these kinds of foodborne outbreaks, very hard to track unless you have very strong communications networks between state public health labs.
Actually, I suspect it may be very difficult to do anything because of the trade legislation that's been passed in the past few years. It's actually more possible to control locally produced commodities than it is anything that goes through international trade.
That's right. Now, there are some activists that are trying to bring up the standards, agricultural standards, in countries that we get our food from. But you're right. There is sometimes construed as
restraint of trade
measures. Pardon me.
Restraint of trade.
Yes. Well, yes, that's right. So these global forces are oftentimes at odds with public health.
Well, I'm enjoying, or at least I'm finding your talk very interesting. I think we've been extraordinarily lucky over the last few years because of the virulent diseases we've found were not terribly contagious. If
that's right,
something as deadly as AIDS were to be as infectious as the Spanish flu, with our transportation today.
Uh-huh. That's right. We're very lucky that AIDS is, for example, not an airborne organism. You know, when I was talking to some public health people for this book, I asked them, what would be the next Andromeda strain that you could see? What would be the worst kind of infectious disease that could strike humankind? And what they described was an organism that was airborne, that had a short incubation period, that easily transmitted between people, moved fast. And essentially what they were describing was the flu virus.
Mm-hmm.
And a flu pandemic, we haven't talked about it, but that is a real looming public health threat.
Mm. We have to wrap up here, but before we do that, given that emerging infections are so difficult to predict, and sometimes they're difficult to discover.
Yes.
How are we preparing for something that you just mentioned, the idea of an Andromeda strain?
What we have to do, and the point that I try to make in the book, is that we need a very strong public health system, and that means we need very sharp surveillance. We have to know what's out there in real time. We need a very strong response. We need lots more epidemiologists than we have. We need real-time information connections between public health departments, and we need steady funding. You know, now that this new bioterrorism initiative has come out and President Bush has proposed $6 billion just next year to improve the public health system, what public health officials in states and localities are most afraid of is that the funding will dry up as soon as this becomes
become complacent.
Right.
Once again. Yeah.
That's right.
We've got to wrap it up here. We're out of time. Madeline, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Madeline Drexler has been our guest this afternoon. She is the author of Secret Agents, The Menace of Emerging Infections. The book is published by the Joseph Henry Press. It's 1:54 Central Time. Settlement prices in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Carrie Moore.
Thank you, Celeste, and good afternoon. March wheat today had a high of 282 and one-half, the low 280. It settled 280 and three-quarters, down one-quarter. May, the high 288 and one-half, the low 286. It settled 287, unchanged. July, the high 292 and one-quarter, the low 290. It settled 291, unchanged. September, the high 296, the low 295. It settled 295, down one-quarter. December wheat, the high 306, the low 304 and one quarter. It settled 305 and one quarter, up one half. March corn, the high 206, the low 205. It settled 205 and three quarters, up one half. May, the high 213, the low 212. It settled 212 and three quarters, up one half. July, the high 219 and one quarter, the low 218 and one quarter. It settled 218 and three quarters, up one quarter. September, the high 224 and three quarters, the low 223 and three quarters. It settled 224 and one quarter, up three quarters. December, the high 232, the low 231. It settled 231 and three quarters, up three quarters. March, the high 239 and three quarters, the low 239. It settled 239 and one half, up three quarters. March oats, a high 205 and three quarters, the low 202 and one half. It settled 204 and one quarter, up one. May oats, a high 188 and one half, the low 185 and one half. It settled 186 and three quarters, down one quarter. March soybeans, a high 436 and three quarters, the low 430 and one half. It settled 436 and one quarter, up five and one quarter. May, the high 440, the low 434 and one half. It settled 439 and three quarters, up four and one half. July, the high 444, the low 438 and one quarter. It settled 443 and one half, up four and three quarters. August, the high 443, the low 438 and one half. It settled 443, up four and three quarters. September, the high 443 and one half, the low 440 and one half. It settled 443 and one half, up four. November, the high 447 and one half, the low 443. It settled 446 and three quarters, up four and one quarter. January, the high 454, the low 450. It settled 453 and three quarters, up four and one quarter. March soybean meal, the high 149.90, the low 147.80. It settled 149.80, up $2. May, the high 148.40, the low 146.20. It settled 148.30, up 170. March soybean oil, the high 15.49, the low 15.28. It settled 15.48, up 19. May soybean oil, the high 15.70.